Everybody dies, don't they?
Some come back, don't they?
Isn't that so?
You tried to get into the locked drawer today, didn't you? You tried.
How do the dead come back? The Beast in the Cave by H.P. Lovecraft. The horrible conclusion, which had been gradually obtruding itself upon my confused and reluctant mind, was now an awful certainty. I was lost, completely, hopelessly lost, in the vast and labyrinthine recesses of the mammoth cave. Turn as I might, in no direction could my straining vision seize on any object capable of serving as a guidepost to set me on the outward path. That never more should I behold the blessed light of day, or scan the pleasant hills and dales of the beautiful world outside, my reason could no longer entertain the slightest unbelief. Hope had departed. Yet, indoctrinated as I was by a life of philosophical study, I derived no small measure of satisfaction from my unimpassioned demeanour. For, although I had frequently read of the wild frenzies into which were thrown the victims of similar situations, I experienced none of these, but stood quiet as soon as I clearly realized the loss of my bearings. Nor did the thought that I had probably wandered beyond the utmost limits of an ordinary search cause me to abandon my composure, even for a moment. If I must die, I reflected, then was this terrible yet majestic cavern as welcome a sepulchre as that which any churchyard might afford, a conception which carried with it more of tranquillity than of despair. Starving would prove my ultimate fate, of this I was certain. Some, I knew, had gone mad under circumstances such as these, but I felt that this end would not be mine. My disaster was the result of no fault save my own, since, unbeknown to the guide, I had separated myself from the regular party of sightseers, and wandering for over an hour in forbidden avenues of the cave, had found myself unable to retrace the devious windings which I had pursued since forsaking my companions. Already my torch had begun to expire. Soon I would be enveloped by the total and almost palpable blackness of the bowels of the earth. As I stood in the waning, unsteady light, I idly wondered over the exact circumstances of my coming end. I remembered the accounts which I had heard of the colony of consumptives who, taking their residence in this gigantic grotto to find health from the apparently salubrious air of the underground world, with its steady, uniform temperature, pure air and peaceful quiet, had found, instead, death in strange and ghastly form. I had seen the sad remains of their ill-made cottages as I passed them by with the party, and had wondered what unnatural influence a long sojourn in this immense and silent cavern would exert upon one as healthy and as vigorous as I. Now, I grimly told myself, my opportunity for settling this point had arrived, provided that want of food should not bring me too speedy a departure from this life. As the last fitful rays of my torch faded into obscurity, I resolved to leave no stone unturned, no possible means of escape neglected. So, summoning all the powers possessed by my lungs, I set up a series of loud shoutings in the vain hope of attracting the attention of the guide by my clamour. Yet, as I called, I believed in my heart that my cries were to no purpose, and that my voice, magnified and reflected by the numberless ramparts of the black maze about me, fell upon no ears save my own. All at once, however, my attention was fixed with a start, as I fancied that I heard the sound of soft approaching steps on the rocky floor of the cavern. Was my deliverance about to be accomplished so soon? Had, then, all my horrible apprehensions been for naught? And was the guide, having marked my unwarranted absence from the party, following my course and seeking me out in this limestone labyrinth? Whilst these joyful queries arose in my brain, I was on the point of renewing my cries in order that my discovery might come the sooner, when, in an instant, my delight was turned to horror as I listened. for my ever acute ear, now sharpened in even greater degree by the complete silence of the cave, bore to my benumbed understanding the unexpected and dreadful knowledge that these footfalls were not like those of any mortal man. In the unearthly stillness of this subterranean region, the tread of the booted guide would have sounded like a series of sharp and incisive blows. These impacts were soft and stealthy, as of the padded paws of some feline. Besides, at times, when I listened carefully, I seemed to trace the falls of 4 instead of 2 feet. I was now convinced that I had by my cries aroused and attracted some wild beast, perhaps a mountain lion which had accidentally strayed within the cave. Perhaps, I considered, the Almighty had chosen me for a swifter and more merciful death than that of hunger. Yet the instinct of self-preservation, never wholly dormant, was stirred in my breast, and though escape from the oncoming peril might but spare me for a sterner and more lingering end, I determined nevertheless to part with my life at as high a price as I could command. Strange as it may seem, my mind conceived of no intent on the part of the visitor save of that of hostility. Accordingly, I became very quiet in the hope that the unknown beast would, in the absence of a guiding sound, lose its direction as had I, and thus pass me by. But this hope was not destined for realization, for the strange footfalls steadily advanced, the animal evidently having obtained my scent, which in an atmosphere so absolutely free from all distracting influences as is that of the cave, could doubtless be followed at great distance. Seeing, therefore, that I must be armed for defence against an uncanny and unseen attack in the dark, I grouped about me the largest of the fragments of rock which were strewn upon all parts of the floor of the cavern in the vicinity, and grasping one in each hand for immediate use, awaited with resignation the inevitable result. Meanwhile, the hideous pattering of the paws drew near. Certainly, the conduct of the creature was exceedingly strange. Most of the time, the tread seemed to be that of a quadruped, walking with a singular lack of unison betwixt hind and forefeet. Yet, at brief and infrequent intervals, I fancied that but 2 feet were engaged in the process of locomotion. I wondered what species of animal was to confront me. It must, I thought, be some unfortunate beast who had paid for its curiosity to investigate one of the entrances of the fearful grotto with a lifelong confinement in its interminable recesses. It doubtless obtained as food the eyeless fish, bats, and rats of the cave, as well as some of the ordinary fish that are wafted in at every freshet of Green River, which communicates in some occult manner with the waters of the cave. I occupied my terrible vigil with grotesque conjectures of what alterations cave life might have wrought in the physical structure of the beast, remembering the awful appearances ascribed by local tradition to the consumptives who had died after long residence in the cavern. Then I remembered with a start that even should I succeed in killing my antagonist, I should never behold its form, as my torch had long since been extinct, and I was entirely unprovided with matches. The tension on my brain now became frightful. My disordered fancy conjured up hideous and fearsome shapes from the sinister darkness that surrounded me, and that actually seemed to press upon my body. Nearer, nearer the dreadful footfalls approached. It seemed that I must give vent to a piercing scream, yet had I been sufficiently irresolute to attempt such a thing, my voice could scarce have responded. I was petrified. Rooted to the spot, I doubted if my right arm would allow me to hurl its missile at the oncoming thing when the crucial moment should arrive. Now, the steady pat-pat of the steps was close at hand. Now, very close. I could hear the laboured breathing of the animal, and terror-struck as I was, I realised that it must have come from a considerable distance and was correspondingly fatigued. Suddenly the spell broke. My right hand, guided by my ever-trustworthy sense of hearing, threw with full force the sharp-angled bit of limestone which it contained toward that point in the darkness from which emanated the breathing and pattering, and, wonderful to relate, it nearly reached its goal, for I heard the thing jump landing at a distance away, where it seemed to pause. Having readjusted my aim, I discharged my second missile, this time most effectively, for with a flood of joy I listened as the creature fell in what sounded like a complete collapse and evidently remained prone and unmoving. Almost overjoyed by the great relief which rushed over me, I reeled back against the wall. The breathing continued in heavy, gasping inhalations and expirations, whence I realized that I had no more than wounded the creature, and now all desire to examine the thing ceased. At last, something allied to groundless, superstitious fear had entered my brain, and I did not approach the body, nor did I continue to cast stones at it in order to complete the extinction of its life. Instead, I ran at full speed in what was, as nearly as I could estimate, in my frenzied condition, the direction from which I had come. Suddenly I heard a sound, or rather a regular succession of sounds. In another instant they had resolved themselves into a series of sharp metallic clicks. This time there was no doubt. It was the guide. And then I shouted, yelled, screamed, even shrieked with joy as I beheld in the vaulted arches above the faint and glimmering effulgence, which I knew to be the reflected light of an approaching torch. I ran to meet the flare, and before I could completely understand what had occurred, was lying on the ground at the feet of the guide, embracing his boots and gibbering, despite my boasted reserve, in a most meaningless and idiotic manner, pouring out my terrible story, and at the same time overwhelming my auditor with protestations of gratitude. At length I awoke to something like my normal consciousness. The guide had noted my absence upon the arrival of the party at the entrance of the cave, and had, from his own intuitive sense of direction, proceeded to make a thorough canvass of the by-passages just ahead of where he had last spoken to me, locating my whereabouts after a quest of about 4 hours. By the time he had related this to me, I, emboldened by his torch and his company, began to reflect upon the strange beast which I had wounded but a short distance back in the darkness, and suggested that we ascertain, by the rushlight's aid, what manner of creature was my victim. Accordingly, I retraced my steps, this time with a courage born of companionship, to the scene of my terrible experience. Soon we descried a white object upon the floor, an object whiter even than the gleaming limestone itself. Cautiously advancing, we gave vent to a simultaneous ejaculation of wonderment, for of all the unnatural monsters either of us had in our lifetimes beheld, this was in surpassing degree the strangest. It appeared to be an anthropoid ape of large proportions, escaped perhaps from some itinerant menagerie. Its hair was snow-white, a thing no doubt due to the bleaching action of a long existence within the inky confines of the cave, but it was also surprisingly thin, being indeed largely absent save on the head, where it was of such length and abundance that it fell over the shoulders in considerable profusion. The face was turned away from us, as the creature lay almost directly upon it. The inclination of the limbs was very singular, explaining, however, the alternation in their use which I had before noted, whereby the beast used sometimes all four, and on other occasions but two, for its progress. From the tips of the fingers or toes, long nail-like claws extended. The hands or feet were not prehensile, a fact that I ascribed to that long residence in the cave, which, as I before mentioned, seemed evident from the all-pervading and almost unearthly whiteness so characteristic of the whole anatomy. No tail seemed to be present. The respiration had now grown very feeble, and the guide had drawn his pistol with the evident intent of dispatching the creature, when a sudden sound emitted by the latter caused the weapon to fall unused. The sound was of a nature difficult to describe. It was not like the normal note of any known species of simian, and I wondered if this unnatural quality were not the result of a long-continued and complete silence, broken by the sensations produced by the advent of the light, a thing which the beast could not have seen since its first entrance into the cave. The sound, which I might feebly attempt to classify as a kind of deep-toned chattering, was faintly continued. All at once A fleeting spasm of energy seemed to pass through the frame of the beast. The paws went through a convulsive motion and the limbs contracted. With a jerk, the white body rolled over so that its face was turned in our direction. For a moment, I was so struck with horror at the eyes thus revealed that I noted nothing else. They were black, those eyes, deep, jetty black, in hideous contrast to the snow-white hair and flesh. Like those of other cave denizens, they were deeply sunken in their orbits and were entirely destitute of iris. As I looked more closely, I saw that they were set in a face less prognathous than that of the average ape and infinitely more hairy. The nose was quite distinct. As we gazed upon the uncanny sight presented to our vision, the thick lips opened and several sounds issued from them, after which the thing relaxed in death. The guide clutched my coat sleeve and trembled so violently that the light shook fitfully, casting weird, moving shadows on the walls about us. I made no motion, but stood rigidly still, my horrified eyes fixed upon the floor ahead. Then fear left, and wonder, awe, compassion, and reverence succeeded in its place, for the sounds uttered by the stricken figure that lay stretched out on the limestone had told us the awesome truth. The creature I had killed, the strange beast of the unfathomed cave, was, or had at one time been, a man.
Everybody dies, don't they? Everybody come back, don't they? Isn't that so?
Welcome, Todd. We've just heard the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Beast in the Cave, and you very kindly sent me a copy of your chapbook of The Beast in the Cave, which you've taken Lovecraft's story. I'm going to show some video of this so people can see it better. You've illustrated it. It's a limited edition, but you've put this wonderful things like the flashlight bookmark in it. And it's absolutely a beautiful piece of work. The people won't be able to feel it, but even the paper quality, this feels like a precious object, you know. So before we get ahead of ourselves, I just wanted to ask you about how did you come? I mean, I guess I'm interested in the story. Why did you pick that? But I'm particularly interested in how did you come to make such a thing as this?
Okay. Well, I run Angel Bomb, which is a small letterpress print shop in Minnesota in the United States. And I've been running Angel Bomb since 1997, so 26 years now. Primarily, it was set up for doing client work. I'm a graphic designer, so I've been a designer for over 30 years. And so it was mostly client-based, but about 10 years ago, I made my first book as a professional, and it was a graphic novel that I wrote. And so I've been getting more and more into book arts, less, you know, kind of drifting away from the client work and focusing on fine book arts. And a lot of my projects are either science fiction or horror based. And I like those as a way of looking at or analyzing kind of problems in society. And I've done a couple of works. Well, I've done one other piece that was Lovecraft inspired. It was like an ode to Lovecraft. I grew up in a small town in North Dakota, which was just culturally deficit. And a small town thinking, like there was just no creativity. And as a creative person, even as a youth, like I just struggled. And discovering Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft was like a boon to me, and just kind of opened my eyes to a broader world. It kind of gave me this love of the New England setting with the twisted boughs on branches and, you know, the hills and the valleys and the just this beautiful area, which also had this sort of spookiness. But I loved Lovecraft for his otherworldly, you know, unnameable creatures. And so it was really, I wanted to do something, a small little chapbook that would sort of honor this history that I have with him and his stories, and was looking for something. Most of my projects take a long time, a couple of years at least. And so I wanted to do something that was a little bit shorter. I'm so inspired by pulps, the early pulp stories, as well as like the illustrations. I mean, I think, you know, so much of science fiction, so much of the what we see today owes a you know, owes something to that kind of the golden age of sci-fi era in the, you know, early to mid 1900s. And so I just wanted to do a little piece that sort of paid tribute to that.
So how long did it take you to produce this?
It actually took close to a year, but that was, I'm always working on multiple projects at once. And it kind of took me a while to determine like the illustrative style. That's always kind of unique. I want typically each project I do looks different. And I wanted this to really have this. I was reading a lot of like old creepy and weird tales comics. And so I was really wanted to pull that style of illustration in as well. So it was probably like 9 months to a year.
And I mean, I think, you know, we talk about the pulp magazines are like amazing stories and things like that. And
mm-hmm.
They were all, they were pretty disposable. They were cheaply produced, cheap paper. You read it. And I guess people did collect them. Of course they did. But I don't think they were intended for collection. Yet this is a real quality piece of work. This story has probably never been produced in such quality as this.
Probably not. Yeah.
And the paper itself. Tell me about the paper. How do you source the paper?
So one of the things that I do when I work on a book project is I have an interest in experientiality or like the experience of interacting with the book. I seek to draw people in and have them make a deeper connection with the story through their interaction with it, instead of just turning the page in a single narrative. I mean, this is a pretty straightforward one, but I still kind of hid things throughout there that, you know, would kind of delight you as you explore. There's some blind impressions of the stalactites and stalagmites on the cover. The dust jacket, if you hold it up to the light, it looks like a watermark through the cover there.
It does.
And then with that, with the sewn in flashlight as a bookmark. So this is really kind of playing across the idea of that this book is all about like fear of the other. And so it kind of, in the way my mind works when I want to put a story on the paper, how can I expand that? How can I bring sort of my own creativity, my own thoughts to that story while still paying tribute, you know, not changing it? So I thought that especially with Lovecraft's famous quote about fear, you know, the strongest emotion of man is fear. The strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. I thought that felt really, that tied in so well with the story. And it seems to really hearken to a lot of things that's going on in the world today. We've got bigger issues to deal with, but we're still worried about that dude because his clothes are weird or their color is different or something. And it's just, I don't know. I guess that's something I want to analyze and kind of bring to the forefront.
It's very tactile, as you say. The cover, which people won't get unless they touch it, the weight of it, the feel. I'm running my fingers over the cover because it's embossed. I don't know if that is the technically correct way of saying it. It feels embossed. You know, there is a text you to it. Mm-hmm. The flashlight bookmark, which has a little message, a quote from Lovecraft on the back. Even the thread is like a quality thread. I don't know if it's a wax thread or, but it feels, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very arresting thing. So it's really interesting what you say about, people might not be able to see this they won't be able to see it if it's a podcast, of course. But, you know, take my word for it. It's wonderfully done, you know. And when you sent it to me, I thought, because normally I talk to writers as writers, but interestingly, I recently did an interview with Lewis Daly, who was a filmmaker and an animator, really, as well as a writer. So but it just grabbed me, you know, it really did. It really did grab me there. Now, I've been reading a book. There's a book I've been reading called Saving the Appearances by a guy called Owen Barfield, who was dead. And he was a friend of C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien and people like that. He was one of the Inklings. And it's a hard book, you know. But one of the things he says is that if you think, you know, when you would drink coffee, we think we can separate it into I drink coffee as if they're separate things. But these experiences don't come in parts. We do that like post hoc. We do that after the event. So we experience the thing as a whole. So all our experiences are a whole. So when we're reading the book. A funny thing people say to me, if I ever, they like hearing the turning of the pages. So I used to think, right, I want to edit that out. We want just the pure voice. But then no, they like the turning of the pages because I think that's part of that whole book reading experience. And so for me, particularly with this book, the feel of it, I can't get over the visuals of it, the arresting graphics, but also the feel of the page. And some of they are slightly, are they slightly different style? No, maybe not. They're not. I saw some of them. I thought, well, yeah, that looks slightly different. But, you know, people are going to see it. So what I'm saying about Owen Barfield is the fact that he would say, you know, when you drink the coffee, it's a full. So when you read a book, it is the full experience of reading the book. You don't go, the story is in my head, but what are my fingers doing? Is separate. I think it enhances the story. So, and the other thing you said that was interesting is you have a similar task to me in lots of ways. In that when people say, "Oh, read a story," yeah, it's not just it's about getting the right story at the right length, that is the right feel and is the right. You know, it has to be a lot of right things. And it sounds like you picked I didn't know this one, The Beast in the Cave. I don't think I'd ever read it.
It's like if I recall correctly, like he started it when he was 14, and then I think it was first published when he was 15. I liked it because there's a lot of these, and I read a lot of like old sort of anthologies. So like right now I'm reading a Twilight Zone anthology that contains all the original stories from like the first two seasons that were then, you know, changed into screenplays for the first two seasons of the show. And I mean, I grew up on those. And so to read the original stories and compare to the television show is really unique. But so I read a lot of these, you know, these older stories, and something that draws me is these twist endings at the end. Or the, you know, these twists at the end. And I thought that this was a delight, even though as you read it as an adult, I think you can pretty much see it coming. But it almost felt to me like this would be a good introduction to not only like Lovecraft and horror for a young person, but almost an introduction to the book as a collectible as well. You know, I'm considered a fine press book artist, even though, you know, I've done a lot of horror and science fiction versus, say, like, you know, Thoreau, which a lot of traditional book artists, you know, may gravitate towards. So it's a little bit of a unique niche, but it's something in trying to, because I felt such delight in discovering these stories as a kid. I kind of wanted to do something that if you had a young person that you could introduce them to this, and it's not rife with his racism like his some of his later stuff. It's, you know, you get a sense of his vocabulary starting to grow, you know, I can't remember if I think I read it somewhere where basically someone was like, you know, Lovecraft, why use 10 words when 26 will do or something, you know? And there are these syllabic words and they're long. And it's just like, as a kid, I had to look, you know, I'd look those up. What does this mean? And it was, again, just kind of part of that discovery. And you can, even though I think this, you know, this is a youthful story for him, or a story from his youth, you can see that coming. You can kind of feel that direction. That he's going to, and I think that kind of gives a little bit greater depth or insight as well. You know, seeing something from different stages of someone's career.
I mean, I think about Lovecraft's use of language is easily pastiched, if you like. You know, the unspeakably blasphemous, squamous, blah, blah, yeah. blah, you know. And it's easy to do that. But I think he's coming from, in many ways, I know he's looking forward. His cosmic horror kind of is a development of horror themes. I read a lot of the classic ghost stories and these weird tales. And with Ashton Smith and people like that, they're coming. They're looking forward at a new development, is what I'm trying to say. But this ornate vocabulary is something very Victorian, whereby the Victorians felt, you know, they were going to use these big words that you wouldn't use in ordinary language to heighten it, I think, and to make it a separate experience. It wasn't intended to be naturalistic, you know, like we will, you know, these days you write, you pick up a novel and it's written in kind of street language, you know, to be immediate. But they weren't doing that. And they knew nobody spoke like this. They knew that. But it's to try and stretch your vocabulary. So I think that is interesting. Not so much cosmic horror in this one, but the phobia. I mean, there is a little bit in that, the weirdness of the no spoilers because people have read it. The milk white ape man, if you like, that is fairly weird, but the getting lost somewhere underground is in the, I mean, I don't know if Magatina Lasky did one called The Tower, which is all about vertigo. It's a phobia story. Basil Copper did one called The Spider, which is an arachnophobia story. So there is a fine tradition of single phobia stories, if you like, you know, and that's what this is. When you were talking about, I'm going to, you know, my mind jumped.
So, no, go right ahead.
Yeah, okay. We were talking about you're talking about North Dakota. Now, you have to understand my U.S. geography is rudimentary, so I can kind of point vaguely to a map of the states where that is. How far are you from Utah?
So North Dakota is borders Canada in the middle of the country. So it's central, far north. Utah would be further west, and then further south. I'm not sure how to say like how many miles or kilometers it is, but it's about like maybe a third of the country away, or like a quarter away.
So it's a fair way.
Exactly.
Away. Yeah, a fair way away. Yeah. And I'll tell you why I was saying that, because I remember flying over it once, but the Skinwalker Ranch jumped into my, you know, because there's those kind of cryptids that lurk in the middle of the vast empty middle of the USA, you know, in and you were talking about the sun-baked plains, I think you said in the beginning. So I'm like, oh yeah, what lurks there? I mean, what things are lurking there? And that seemed very Lovecraftian, but I'm 1,000 miles out. Yeah, you know. Yeah. So the climate is hot in the summer and cold. It's like a continental climate, hot in summer, cold, very, very cold in the winter.
Yes. And where I grew up, I mean, there weren't a lot of trees, so it wasn't like a lot of shade. And I was also working on a on a farm. So it's like you're out in a dusty field all the time. And I hated it. So like in the winter, when you couldn't be like to curl up inside, and you know, it's like the wind would rush down from you know, from Canada. It's very windy there. And, you know, with the blowing snow, like that was just the perfect setting to curl up with a book and just get lost.
There's a friend of mine I just seen, and he's saying he's in Oregon, and he's saying it's going to be like minus 10 degrees centigrade tonight. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. Yeah, that is, it's pretty cold though.
It's getting, yeah, it's gotten like, we've got a big kind of like a nationwide storm that's kind of affecting lots of places. So yeah, it's suddenly much colder here than it has been in the last several weeks. So,
and was it work that took you to Minnesota? Was it, you know, how did that happen?
I actually moved to Minnesota, to attend college. So I'm in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. This is where I went to school. And, you know, this was back in the late '80s. And then, I did go into the Navy, and I've moved a little bit, but always came back because there's a lot of nature around. Like Minnesota is much more wooded. We're known as like the land of 10,000 lakes. So there's just a lot of nature to be had. And it's something that I really like as that, you know, being able to kind of put your daily worries away and just get out and sort of really enjoy nature without feeling like, you know, you're just getting baked by the sun and it's just uncomfortable.
So is it like a wilderness? I mean, I imagine it's, when you get out, there's not a lot of, I don't know, but is it an empty sort of place from people once you get away from the cities?
Not, well, yes and no. I mean, not it's not completely vacant. I mean, there's lots of like small towns and stuff, but you can, you know, you could basically, there's like, where I really like to say holiday is go up to the North Shore, which the northern northeast portion of Minnesota borders one of the Great Lakes. So it's very rocky up there. There's a lot of, you know, the trees are more coniferous, so it feels, I've always loved Colorado for the mountains. So it kind of feels like that without being as large or majestic, but it's just, you get a sense of ruggedness and wilderness. You know, so if you've ever read any like Jack London or something, it kind of harkens back to that.
Yeah, Grant. And what other projects are you involved in at the moment? What else are you doing?
I'm working on a fun project. I could run over and grab it. The last big project that I did was John W. Campbell's, Who Goes There? And which is the basis for all the Thing movies.
Yeah.
And, so that story is near and dear to my heart. Like I remember stumbling across the movie at my grandparents' house, when they left me alone for, you know, a rare occasion where they went out to lunch, and I got to use their cable television, which we didn't have, and stumbled across this movie with these effects of these creatures, and it just scared the bejesus out of me. I mean, I ran outside in the front lawn just because it was like sunny and bright and like nothing can get me here. And so basically it took me a few years to find who had the copyrights to that and how could I work with them, and found the literary agency, and then we worked up a contract. So I created a limited edition of Who Goes There. And then one of my patrons that bought it asked me if I'd ever heard of Peter Watts's The Things. And so I'd said no, and I looked it up and read it. And so Peter Watts is a contemporary Canadian author. He's a zoobiologist. He's got a brilliant mind. And he took this story of the thing and rewrote it from the viewpoint of the alien itself. And so it's so good. It's so good. And so I reached out to him and I said, hey, can I, you know, make a version of your book? And so right now That's what I'm working on. I'm going to be launching it later this month, and basically taking pre-orders. I've done a lot of illustrations for it, and I'm working on like the binding and how the book itself will look. But that whole sort of like that, you know, that universe, like a Marvel universe or the DC universe or whatever, this sort of universe around the thing, this idea of this creature that's, you know, evolved far beyond humankind, that it can change shape and it's conquered all these worlds. So it has this knowledge of eons of societies alone here on Earth, and trying to it's like it wakes up and the humans are trying to kill it, and he's just like, what's going on, you know? And it's just delightful. And so I've been really working hard on like, how do you illustrate a story? How do you show something from the viewpoint that's so drastically different? And so that's been a very fun, a fun project to kind of dig into.
Well, you've sold it to me. I now want to get hold of all your books, you know. So that's a good segue into how do people get hold of your work?
Yeah. So I'm in a few, a few book dealers carry my work in the United States. If any of your, you know, listeners or viewers in the UK or elsewhere are interested in carrying it, I would be happy to talk to them. But for most people, the easiest way would be to go to my website. So it's angelbomb.com, just all one word.
Nice and easy, angelbomb.com, yeah. I was thinking, there was that, when we were in the States last, I went into a bookshop in Providence, Rhode Island, in the arcade, which is the H.P. Lovecraft bookshop. You maybe been there.
Yes, I've been there. It's like the Lovecraft Arts and Science.
That's it. Yes. Do they have your book work there? They should do if they haven't.
They've been difficult to work with. I can't remember if they bought one or not. It would be perfect. It would be perfect to go there.
Somebody contacted me who has a shop in that arcade, heard the podcast, and I said, I've been in there. And they went, you must have walked past our shop. You know, they weren't the Lovecraft. So it's amazing who listens to this now. I'm constantly amazed. People say, oh, yeah, I was listening to your podcast. I'm like, oh, blimey.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So you never know. So if anybody wants to carry it or get in touch with you in the first instance. And the other thing that you've said that is interesting, sparked my interest, is, you know, kind of working with, I've done kind of some live, like living authors work, but there are other people like Hell House, Matheson's Hell House, you know, he did I Am Legion, and Richard Matheson. And I thought, oh God, I would love to do a version of that. But it's that shyness about reaching out to them and then thinking they're going to tie up in legal knots and you're going to end up paying a fortune to do a version of it. But it sounds like that isn't the case with many people.
Well, we'll see. It's interesting. I had I don't know what the average sort of percentage is, but I felt with working with the, you know, like the literary agency that handles Campbell's estate, I felt that they were completely reasonable, and maybe in part because they've been doing it for a long time, or, you know, working with live authors, I had sent my first proof to Peter, and, you know, his response was a little bit surprising. It turns out, like, I couldn't remember where I got my basic document. So it turned out like there were some errors in that I wasn't aware of. So he was surprised by that or disappointed. But it's like, okay, well, you send me the official copy and we'll get this fixed. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, slip one over on you and, you know, slip in, you know, do anything radically different to your story. but you know, he seemed, you know, pretty content or open to the idea of like, I made this story. If you want to do, you know, I've done my bit with it. You know, if you want to do something, you know, here, feel welcome. So
and of course, but you in a sense not transform it, but everybody changes it. Your interpretation through your art is an addition to his. He's been one person, you're another person. Mm-hmm. And say, you know, in the way I do with things, my then voice interpretation is yet another aspect of the story. But, you know, I feel like that myself. If I write something, well, I've done that. Even just in the reception of it, you maybe have the same idea. People respond to your work in their own way, and you can't predict how they will. And even if they, and let's say the people who love it, they love it in their own way, you know, and they have their own resonances and their own attachments to it. So, but yeah, it is interesting. So maybe I'll be a bit braver and contact people. So, okay, I can see from the clock we're running out of time. So I don't know if you can see the clock there, but there is a clock counting us down. No, I can see it, yeah. So I don't want to kind of end it halfway through. So angelbomb.com, you've done a whole ton of work already that people can access.
Yep, I've The Beast in the Cave was my seventh book, so they're, you know, they vary in size and scope, but you know, right now the next book I'll be publishing is The Things. I've got a couple of more personal works coming after that, but I'm also here, like, this is the first time that I've spoken about this publicly, but next year, like in 1 year, I'm going to be sailing to Antarctica.
Wow!
For thank you for a for research for some books based on climate change, but also because I want to do my own interpretation of this idea of an alien creature on that continent, and so I'm going to go and do research there. So eventually, I'll have created like a trilogy of books sort of based around the thing, like with Who Goes There, The Things, and then my forthcoming project. So
that's massively exciting. Be careful of the mountains of madness.
I will.
but yeah, fantastic. We're about to be cut off. So.
And at that point, dear listener, we were cut off. I think we had an exchange of emails to see whether we should reconnect, but I think everything to be said had been said. So remember, angelbomb.com, Todd Thyberg. I'll put the links in the show notes. It was a nice, interesting diversion. The story itself was simple. It was short. It was one of Lovecraft's early ones. Did he say, I didn't know this, but he was 14 years old when he wrote it. If that's true, that's pretty good. It's not a bad story at all for a 14-year-old. Goodness me, no. But Todd's work, honestly, is a tactile delight and a visual delight as well with the illustrations. And you can see how they harken back to the pulp illustrations and that whole tradition of illustrating stories, which I always liked, which was a big thing, which we've fallen out of these days. But I like illustrated books. And I think the final thing I want to say is, of course, a book, I do use e-readers, but a book is a book. A book is not just the words in it. It is the feel of it. It is the object. And I think many of you, I'm probably preaching to the converted here. I'm sure many of you actually have books. For those of you who go with e-readers, I'm not dissing you. I'm just saying, you know, just feel those books. Get one of Todd's books. Just feel it. The paper, the embossing, the art. It's and the little Easter eggs that he puts in. Definitely well worth it. So back to classic, well, it was a classic weird tale, I suppose. More of that soon.
Everybody dies, don't they? Isn't that so?
Music, as always, by Jonathan Sharp of the Hartwood Institute. And of course, the words, the sample is from the 1970s Satanist biker movie, or zombie biker movie, I can't remember. I have seen it, Psychomania. It was called something else in the US, something like Satanic Hell's Angels or something. But it's a very British film, to be fair. So anyway, Jonathan, thanks to Jonathan, as always. Thanks to Todd. Thanks to you for listening. Hope I didn't wake you up.